In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Whether you like to vacation to the beach once a year, adventure to the top of a mountain in a faraway place, or just explore a new city for the long weekend, the pandemic has replaced what was once a respite from the everyday with concerns of cleanliness and overcrowding. And in the process, it has upended an industry that employs an estimated 1 in 10 jobs worldwide. For decades, the industry has been growing uncontrollably, amassing new seats on a train with unlimited tickets, barreling towards a sunset that never quite dips below the horizon. And the results are worrying.
These are images from high up on Everest, the path to the peak clogged with climbers, making the treacherous trek to the top of the world that much more dangerous.
More than 1 million people took in the beautiful Croatian walled city last year, but Dubrovnik is becoming a victim of its own success.
Tourists end up producing 4.8 million tons of trash per year, and 14% of that is solid waste. And it's the big sites with the biggest problems. Mount Everest, Machu Picchu, Stonehenge are all struggling with an increase of trash left behind.
The pandemic has allowed us to reimagine many things in our society, and travel could be one of them. So as travel restrictions start to ease in Europe and other parts of the world, can we imagine an industry with a limited number of seats on a train that's a bit harder to get a ticket for? And would our monuments and places where they reside be better off for it? And where does that leave the traveler looking for a budget vacation? I'm Stephanie Phillips, and this is The Big Story. Christopher de Beleg is a writer currently based in London. He wrote about the future of the travel industry for The Guardian. Hi, Christopher.
Hello, Stephanie.
I guess I want to start with, how big is the tourism industry globally? Can you give me a general overview?
The tourism industry is difficult to quantify because you have direct tourism. So you have tour operators, airlines, that sort of direct tourism-related activity. And then you have an enormous amount of people who work off of the back of tourism, so who provide services that may be part of tourism globally. It could be looking after jet skis at a beach resort, or it could be arranging insurance for the over 80s. It's an enormous industry if you take it at its widest extent. And if you do that, then you can say that 1 in 10 jobs in the global economy are in some way dependent on tourism. It's a massive, massive part of the global economy, and it is getting more and more massive. Essentially, it's been growing very, very quickly since the last economic crisis of 2008-2009. And this year, for example, it was projected that there would be 4% more arrivals, international arrivals, compared to last year. The largest cohort and the fastest growing cohort in world tourism is the Chinese, and they are traveling. Their rapidly expanding middle class is traveling at a really, really very, very impressive rate. That rate of increase.
What was that rate of increase expected to be for this year before coronavirus happened?
The Chinese travelers were expected to make 160 million trips abroad this year, which is a 27% increase on the 2015 figure. And if you bear in mind that an estimated 10 or 11% of Chinese people even possess a passport, then you can see the rate at which that could potentially increase and the potential for Chinese tourism to become even more massive than it is now.
Right. I'm kind of picturing like a snowball effect. It just growing and growing with no end in sight. But then the coronavirus kind of came along and halted international travel. So what losses are we seeing in cities and countries that depend on this tourism?
Well, it's interesting. At the beginning of the coronavirus, there was quite a lot of optimistic talk in the tourism industry, because the tourism industry prides itself on its resilience and also really regards tourists as the water in a balloon that you can press on one side, it'll just simply go somewhere else. So after the last economic crisis, you had a downtick, but then you had a massive increase. After 9/11, you didn't have any American tourists traveling, but the Europeans tended to make up the difference. But gradually, as the pandemic took hold everywhere, it became clear that this rationale, that this logic, just wasn't tenable. And recently, the UNWTO, the United Nations World Tourism Organization, which is a kind of watchdog, but is also a kind of cheerleader for the industry, and as a result, can be reliable and can be a little bit partisan, predicted that tourism revenues could drop by 80% this year against last year's figure of $1.7 trillion.
Wow.
And that 120 million jobs could be lost. Now, that is a very dramatic scenario. It may not come to pass. And we should bear in mind that the tourism industry, which the UNWTO does claim to represent, is pushing governments around the world for bailouts and for concessions on environmental and other regulations. So it's very, very serious. We don't know exactly how serious it is, but it's massive.
I want to kind of talk about some of the positives that have also come out of this. So can you explain, what is over-tourism?
Well, the idea of a positive and a negative coexisting is something that we're all, accustomed to now because of the virus. And this has certainly been the case with respect to tourism. I mean, over-tourism, it used to be called saturation. As early as the 1980s, people were talking about saturated destinations that couldn't cope with the number of people that were coming in. That was as a result of the rise of the paid holiday and the liberalisation of the airline industry, which meant that it suddenly became much, much cheaper to fly. Mm. Then you have something called the carrying capacity, which is something that academics use to say that the carrying capacity of Toronto is a certain amount. If you go over that, that means that Toronto's infrastructure will be stressed. And it also means that the way of life that they've identified there, that is something intangible but worth preserving, is under threat. So an example of over-tourism, and it's really the classic example, is Venice, which is, the historic centre of Venice is roughly one and a half times the size of Central Park in New York City. And that area receives 30 million tourists every single year.
Wow.
And 50,000 people live there. You know, the number of people who actually live in Venice, who call it their home, are invested in terms of their life savings, but also their emotions, their creativity, all of that has dropped. And what you find in Venice, for example, but many, many other places around the world, is an economy that is entirely or almost entirely skewed towards tourism. Now, that brings in a lot of money, but where does the money go? A lot of the money goes to investors in the tourism industry that aren't, in fact, Venetian at all, that come from elsewhere and repatriate their profits elsewhere. And so the money that Venice receives, much of it goes away again very quickly. And in my piece for The Guardian, I cited a kind of landmark in the rise of over-tourism in Venice, which was mentioned to me by a couple of Venetians. And that was a concert that Pink Floyd put on there in 1989, the penultimate date of a world tour that they were doing. And Venice, the historic centre of Venice, a medieval city, ill-equipped to deal with numbers of that kind, received something in the region of 200,000 people that day in 1989. These people didn't pay anything to the city of Venice for the privilege of standing in the Piazza San Marco and listening to Pink Floyd. But my word, did they leave a mess behind that the city then had to clear up. And the beneficiaries of that concert were impersonal, outside corporations, most notably the international broadcasting companies that broadcast the concert live. So here you have, almost in a nutshell, the problem of over-tourism. It's squatting on a public good, in this case, a square, a beautiful artifact, and damaging it. It's about damage.
Mm-hmm. What was left after the concert?
So far as I could see, I watched quite a few Italian news programs in the days that were broadcast in the days following the concert. It was a combination of cigarette butts, beer cans, and urine. It was enormous, and the city council had to resign as a result. Now, Venetianization is something that you find around the world now. This idea of Venetianization, meaning the invasion by people who pay very little, not as in the Pink Floyd concert, nothing at all, but who pay very little. These are mass tourists who get disgorged from cruise ships or from tour buses. They come into a city centre, they come into Dubrovnik or Bruges or Barcelona or many, or even Quebec City. And they stay for a very short amount of time. They don't stay in hotels. If they do stay, they're very often staying in Airbnb, which has the effect of pushing up property prices, again, helping to push local people out of the city. And then they go away again, and they don't pay for that privilege.
Right.
And what I'm suggesting is that this is a privilege. It isn't a right. And that privilege needs to be fully costed. And those who avail themselves of that privilege need to pay for it.
And there are some European cities and places who are already, you know, trying to limit tourism and actually make it beneficial for local residents. Can you tell me about some of those places and what they're doing?
In Venice, the effort has been dilatory and not very successful. I think places that are having more success, the town of Bruges, which is a kind of gem of a city in Flanders, has introduced measures to encourage people to stay the night. So they've made it much more expensive for tour buses to park for a short period of time than for 2 or 3 days. They've zoned the city so that it's very difficult to turn an apartment in certain parts of the city into an Airbnb apartment. Mm. And they've placed restrictions on the number of people that can come by cruise ship. So because cruise ships are in a way the kind of gold standard of over-tourism. They are the arch exploiters of a natural or a physical asset, because when you buy a ticket for a cruise, you're expecting everything mm-hmm. to be included. And that means that you're doing most of your eating, most of your spending on board ship.
Right.
And it's not in the cruise liner's interest for you to spend on shore.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
You mentioned that, you know, you're suggesting traveling should be a privilege. And in your piece, you called it kind of a model of elite tourism. And you wrote about how some places in Africa have kind of already adopted this model of elite tourism. What is Kenya doing, for example? And, you know, why are they doing it? Because from what I understand, they're doing it for different reasons.
Well, if you could very crudely set up tourism as a battlefield between mass and elite tourism, then on the one hand, you have a country like Indonesia, which has a large number of young people coming into the workforce. And the Indonesian government says, we want lots of people to work in tourism. It doesn't matter if the tourists don't pay very much, but we need employment generated. So what we're going to do is we're going to encourage mass tourism. Mm. The alternative is, particularly if you have a specific goal in mind, And that can obviously often be conservation related. You say, actually, if we have over tourism, that would be catastrophic. What we need is a very small number of tourists, but who are going to pay through the nose. And that will allow us to keep our national parks, our wildlife, our asset, our public good in perfect condition, so that that will be enjoyed by tourists to come. But also the money, the revenue that comes in will go to other parts of the economy and will benefit the country at large. And that in many ways is a lovely idea. It doesn't always work, as I'm about to explain, but Kenya is a very good example of it. And Rwanda is perhaps the most spectacular example of it, because in the 1980s, the famous Rwandan gorillas were on the verge of extinction. And starting then, with the help of conservationists, celebrities, a big publicity campaign, the Rwandan authorities took the decision to make seeing gorillas for just an hour a very, very, very expensive thing to do. So it currently costs you $1,500 to spend an hour in the company of a family of Rwandan gorillas. Now, that obviously means that very few people can afford to do it.
Right.
But those that do pay enough that it really helps the rest of the economy. Now, the problem with this form of elite tourism is that there doesn't seem to be very often a plan B. So when the coronavirus strikes and tourism is hit very hard, but in particular elite tourism, when no one is coming to the national park to see the gorillas, then what do you do? Well, you find yourself with a major problem on your hand, because poaching starts, the gorillas are under threat, and even more so than Rwanda, which currently seems to be doing okay. Elsewhere in sub-Saharan Africa, you have appalling stories of a sudden rise in poaching. Because there is no revenue coming into the country, and there's sometimes not enough money to pay the rangers and the guards, so there's nothing actually to stop poachers from coming in and doing what they always did before tourism came in and offered an alternative.
Right. I guess when you're talking about elite tourism versus mass tourism, I can't help but wonder, like, where does the elite tourism model leave the budget traveler? The person who, you know, is well-intentioned, wants to see the world, experience different things, are they just not supposed to travel anymore?
I don't think that's true at all. If you look at the elite tourist, in general, the more money you have to spend on travel, the worse your effect on the environment. I mean, you may insulate yourself from those effects, but by traveling business class or first class, you're creating much more carbon. It's essentially down to transport. It's about the size of your accommodation, the amount of time you spend using air conditioning. All of these have a very bad effect. And so with the exception of those people who are rich but travel religiously to ecotourism destinations, the richer you are, the more damage you are doing as an individual. However, because you're spending a lot of money, that money can, if properly directed and channeled, be used to mitigate your effect and create long-lasting and sustainable jobs. It depends on the destination. It depends on the way that your money is being spent. Now, I've spoken to a lot of people in the industry who very properly and very understandably react badly to the idea of elite tourism taking over. And what they say is that we need tourism of all budgets. But we do need those people that you described, for whom tourism is important. And in fact, I would say that tourism is a public good, because it brings people of different cultures together. It does everything that our education systems very often don't do, which is open your eyes to other people, to other cultures. All of that needs to be preserved. But what needs to happen is for it to be much harder to go and spend a weekend, for example, in Barcelona for a stag night, much more expensive. It needs to cost more for someone to fly from Bali to the Komodo National Park in Indonesia, more than $50 for the flight, more than $12 to get into the Komodo National Park, where you can see the largest dragon, the Komodo dragon, the largest lizard in the world. More than just a few dollars for the hostel that you spend, so that after a couple of days you come home with change from $100. That is a travesty, because what you're seeing is unrepeatable, it is unique, and it needs to be properly valued. So even for the budget traveller, just like everyone else, needs to have to think about where they travel, why they're travelling, and to commit to travelling better.
That's interesting. We talked about elite tourism and good examples of that model. What is a model of mass tourism that's kind of happening right now? I know you wrote about Indonesia and we talked about it briefly, but what are they trying to do right now?
I think mass tourism is in a spiral, or it certainly was before the coronavirus, because as with every other sector of the economy that was deemed important, the movement forward, the movement towards more growth, ever bigger numbers, prevented proper thought about, you know, what the long-term effects of this sector of the economy was. And what I'm hoping is that mass tourism will wake up and commit to not destroying the assets that it exploits. What needs to happen is for governments to step in. Now, that could be at a national level. It could be at a local level, a municipal level. Governments need to step in and they need to regulate the tourist industry much more closely in order to prevent the destruction of the very assets on which tourism is based. If you're looking for a positive model of mass tourism, that's a work in progress, in my opinion. In my opinion, when you get carrying capacity, for example, in Venice, that's at 30, it's been said to me that carrying capacity of Venice is 20 million. That is the number of people that can possibly be accommodated. And that's 10 million less than the number that are currently going in. And when you have the great big bodies that kind of dominate world tourism saying, oh, we can be sustainable, but we can also have lots more tourists, that just seems to me to be having your cake and eating it. And it seems to me very implausible.
Yeah. So I guess we've kind of talked about all of these different places, but what would responsible tourism, like a responsible trip, look like in your eyes? You know, kind of from start to finish, could you give us an example of that?
I don't think I'd like to sit here and pontificate about the right kind of trip.
Okay.
I can give you a notional example of a trip that I might take. It would be a trip not so far from home. Mm. It would be a trip in which I tried not to fly, tried to take ground transportation. If I did fly, then I would certainly find a way of offsetting my flight that actually burnt a hole in my pocket, wasn't just notional, wasn't just symbolic, $2, $3, $5, but actually burnt a $50 hole in my pocket. And I knew that that money was going towards carbon sequestration somewhere in the world. I would go to a destination where I knew that the money was entering the pockets of local people, because when you have very large interests involved, what happens is that most of the money, as in the case of Venice, gets repatriated elsewhere. It doesn't actually go to local people. I would go to a place where I'd hope I would have the best exposure to that place's cuisine, culinary culture, local people, somewhere where there wasn't a big company, international company, mediating between me and the destination. Now, that may sound very expensive, mm-hmm. And actually quite difficult to arrange, particularly if you have a busy life and you've got an evening at your laptop in which you've got to sort out the family holiday.
Right.
It does require a bit of thought. It requires some reflection. But I would say that thought and reflection is worth it. Mm-hmm. I think we do need to spend more time on our holidays and our tourism. We need to think more about doing it. It should take us more than 5 minutes to work out the best way of traveling, the best way of doing it. I just think it's time well spent.
Okay. I think that's a perfect place to leave our conversation. Thanks so much, Christopher.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Christopher de Belleg is a writer currently based in London. And that was The Big Story. For more from us, you can visit our website, thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also follow along on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And you can write to us to let us know what you think. The email address is thebigstorypodcast@rci.rogers.com. It has been a pleasure hosting this week. Thanks so much for listening. Jordan will be back tomorrow. I'm Stephanie Phillips. We'll talk soon.